Hello, you're listening to a spoiler-filled film conversation. Hooray!
Okay, we're already starting to sound like Marlon Brando by himself on a plane, making weird noises. Right, Marlon, you do you, and we'll just record it and hope for the best.
Hey Brando, how about you pretend you're a drunk Irishman and you just jabber to yourself and we'll film you. You're in love with this horse, go.
Oh God!
We'll
All right.
shoot around it with Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
So, hello, I'm Richard Nicholas. With me is Abby
Hello.
and Jamie.
Hello there. I'm not going to be able to resist doing it the whole time.
And this week we are talking about The Missouri Breaks, which features a very weird Irish impersonation from Marlon Brando, but it's predominantly about Jack Nicholson being hairy and mooching about while other people steal horses. So I've explained the
I think
plot.
that was actually a better summary than the one on IMDb,
Well,
I'm still
Jamie,
going to use it.
we'll go with my explanation of what The Missouri Breaks was, but Jamie will tell you who's in it and who done wrote it and directed it and all that.
Why am I
Jamie?
doing it?
Yeah, why is he doing
Because I don't like Abby this week. Yes, you're
it?
right. It's Abby's pick, and she should get the honours of the tedious admin.
Fuck's sake, you're on one job, Rich.
I got two jobs now, and I'm very tired from the real one, so give me a break.
Okay. The Missouri Breaks is from 1976. It was directed by Arthur Penn, written by Thomas Gawain, and stars Marlon Brando, Jack Nicholson, Randy Quaid, Kathleen Lloyd, Frederick Forrest, Harry Dean Stanley, William, John P. Ryan, and small people.
Small people.
It concerns Tom Logan, who is a horse thief, and a rancher, David Braxton, who has horses and a daughter worth stealing. But Braxton has just hired Lee Clayton, an infamous regulator, to hunt down horse thieves one at a time.
For regulator, read mental person who shoots people.
He doesn't, though. He has a Krull-like throwing blade thing.
It kills
As
people with
well,
what I thought was some kind of thing you do to, like, take the bolts off your car or something.
like one
Like
of
a
the, yeah.
jack. But a spiky one. I don't know what it was. Right, full on, new approach, guys. Expectations. Quickly, and then we could just blather on about it, because I feel like expectations is getting in the way of rambling on about it. So, Abby, you picked it. Why? I mean, what did you expect before you saw it, I guess?
I don't remember the time I had not seen this because I saw it when I was quite young.
Oh,
Wow,
gosh. Traumatizing
what a
experience.
childhood. Yeah.
I wanted to watch something with Randy Quaid in it.
Okay.
Randy Quaid, Jack Nicholson, and Marlon Brando all have a reputation for being absolutely crackers. So the reason I wanted to put this forward is because all three of them are in this, and that meant at least one of them was going to be totally insane. And it was Marlon Brando.
And to be fair, as well, not by a small margin. Like, Jack Nicholson gives a fairly subdued performance, and it's as if Marlon Brando sapped his energy, like he sapped his insanity and took it all into himself.
I reckon Jack Nicholson just knew he was beat. So he was
Yeah,
like, I'm not even going to
I
bother.
can't be with this.
I'm going to be the normal, sympathetic horse rustler, and I'm just going to be, the most eccentric he gets is making a shit little cabbage patch in his little handkerchief
Oh,
hat.
shit, that thing was genius. The little system he had for water in it.
That's irrigation, Holmes.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're impressed by turn of the century
Engineering.
technology.
Well, okay, for the most part, Marlon Brando aside, this film is one of those films that's very much about how hard it is to maintain a small plot of land. Like, yes.
Yeah.
That's mostly what's going on here.
And a million times less boring and miserable than Grapes of Wrath, which is essentially the same. We couldn't, it's just dust and we have to sell and now we're going to be poor and die. Whereas this was at least fun. Oh, it's hard to live here because people don't like crime and it, whatever. Anyway, Jamie, had you seen this before?
No, I had never even heard of it.
Which is weird, because we did Going South, which is very similar wheelhouse, Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, West. Yeah. I mean, obviously you know Going South better than anyone, but... you've seen it like 5 or 6 times by now, surely, but...
I have seen it now. I didn't see it when we reviewed it. Well, I have seen this one.
Well, I'm going to just... I mean, I guess kind of jumping ahead. This does remind me of Going South because it has the same problem that I thought Going South did in that it felt like it should have been a little bit wackier than it was.
Really?
I think the wackiness is subtle and you could not notice it if you weren't thinking. We were thinking watching this, so but I think other people watching just not notice how fucking weird Marlon Brando's being.
Oh, no way. No way did anyone watch this ever and not think, what the fuck is up with Marlon Brando in this film?
Because, I guess, but all the characters react to him like, he's weird. So you might not think this is particular. You know, if characters recognise he's weird, you go, oh, he's a weird character. You know,
you might think it's intentional, is what you're saying. Because if you read about the background of this film, a lot of what Marlon Brando did was not in the script. Like, a lot of this stuff was ad-libbed, and they just had to work around him being extremely weird and difficult to work with.
I think that paid off, though. I can't imagine that any of the stuff that I enjoyed being missing would be better.
I think it would have been a duller film. But anyway, I'd never seen it. I'd never heard of it. And it's like... mid-70s, Jack Nicholson and Brando, I was kind of expecting probably something a bit... Because it's post One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pre-Apocalypse Now by a few years. Mm. So, and that's the film, really, that's sort of notorious in terms of Marlon Brando being insane.
Yeah. I
guess it turns out he went insane... quite a while before that.
Yeah. Oh, he's always been absolutely nuts.
But he started like openly doing it in films.
Yeah, he had to get the credibility to get away with being mental. Yeah. Like, doing, you know, stuff early on, like on the waterfront, that's the sort of role where, you know, if you... I mean, I don't know, maybe he did behave like an ass, but, you know, he has to earn credibility early on.
Yeah, yeah.
Then but once he's a famous guy, it's like, fuck it, I'm going to... be mental.
This was also the first film he did post Last Tango in Paris.
And it was weird butter rape that he actually...
And I mean, yeah, that, like, recent revelations about that film have kind of confirmed a lot of things for a lot of people. So I guess I was expecting something more serious, or at least more dramatic.
Well, I think the title is so boringly generic. It's like, The Missouri Breaks. It's like, oh, it's like a place name Western. Who gives a fuck? Like, it's such a nothing
a
title.
A mid-70s Western, when no one gave a shit about Western.
Yeah,
and, like,
heyday before its renaissance, yeah.
And it was during, you know, the 70s. The 70s was a pretty sort of revolutionary time for mainstream movies and Hollywood in general. It was... just pre-Star Wars, so you had a lot of big films that were very interesting and kind of dark.
This probably gets lost because there's so many more acclaimed films from that time.
Yeah, and I was kind of expecting this to be maybe a lost Western that was more in vein of like the tone of something like, not Taxi Driver, but you know what I mean? I was expecting it to be quite a dark 70s take on Westerns. And it does have that special kind of 70s movie weirdness to it.
Yeah. But. No? No but?
No. I just let it drop in the middle of the road and carried on my own way.
Well, we'll ditch it. I'll say what I thought then. Essentially, Abby showed it to me before, but before I'd seen it, we were just... I think, Abby, did we not watch it just because Marlon Brando is... We were on a... like a
yeah, it was Marlon Brando season. Yeah.
Yeah, so we chucked it in. And I don't know. I just expected it to be an unremarkable Western.
Mm.
But yeah, it's hard to have any expectations because it's such a fucking... You can't tell anything from that name. You don't know what, you know, it's such a... There's cattle rustlers and there's a man who's tries to stop... All right, well, could be anything, couldn't it?
Like, yeah, it's just good, the whole concept, even with the cast, just sounds boring. Like, I was before I watched it, you know, for this, I read the summary on IMDb and immediately was like... and I, like... And then I saw it was, like, 2 fucking hours and 6 minutes. Jesus Christ. Like, yeah, I'm going to have to take a break in the middle of this. Like, but...
I felt like it was going to fall into a category like I've seen Open Range with Robert Duvall, and that's fine, but it is just the story of cowboys in a realistic manner, and it's just like lots of camping out, lots of moving horses, and it's like it's fine. And then something like The Missing, which is a very depressing ride along chasing some Indians trying to get a girl back story, and it's like they're fine films, but you know they don't. You know, I don't know how many times you're going to watch them again.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think this one, having now watched it for a second time, I think it engages me because I just can't believe how odd Brando's being.
Oh, it's almost all Marlon Brando.
Are you trying to figure out why... What is the character meant to just be a bit eccentric? I think generally he's meant to be eccentric, but he's so non-specifically eccentric. Like, Marlon Brando is a guy hired to essentially find out who's been nicking horses. Turns out it's Jack Nicholson, and he's onto them straight away from the get-go. Jack Nicholson and his posse steal horses, and Brando's called in. And Brando approaches it... Like, I'm going to dress up like a fool. I'm going to dress up like a... Like, in a... Like, he wears a broken, like, Chinese hat. Like, what are they
called? The rice paddy hat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of conical hat. And it's all busted up. And he just... No reason for wearing it. And he dresses as a woman at one point and a priest.
Oh.
And he just puts on costumes when he's not being, like, slightly fruity... Like, he's almost like a toned-down Liberace when he first appears in, like, a odd pink suit. And he's got his hair's a bit too long, and he's just a bit fruity, isn't he? Like, and you don't know why he dresses up weirdly. And then on top of that, he's doing this accent, like, supposedly Irish. But he also yabbers to himself. He's possibly in love with his horse in an amusing himself kind of way.
Tell because at one point he drops the accent and has a just an American accent, like a Western-ish American accent, and I couldn't tell, and I guess this was the point, like he probably did this on purpose, but I couldn't tell which one was potentially his real voice or if neither of them were and he actually has a completely different one.
Is it a bad actor who can't consistently do an Irish accent, or is it Brando adding to the role?
Oh no, he definitely dropped it on purpose for that sequence where he's pretending to Randy Quaid's character to be a priest. Like, there he doesn't use the Irish accent.
Mm.
But why he's even Irish in the first place...
I guess the character could be Irish. I mean, you know, the West was full of people from Europe, so it's perfectly acceptable for a character to be Irish.
Yeah, just not Marlon Brando.
Yeah.
Because his Irish accent is somebody telling a racist joke about Irish people in a pub.
It absolutely is.
Hello there, my name's Lee Clayton. Like, it's...
Yeah, it's like... Let me tell you about a leprechaun, shall I? Yeah, it's very weird.
And it just... But... Okay, expectations, I had no idea. I read the trivia and I saw that he was difficult and behaved strangely on set, so I thought it was going to be kind of more of an Apocalypse Now situation where he's just this imposing figure, but he's this weird fucking dandy, like, and it's not a performance. I think everybody has certain expectations from Marlon Brando whenever they see him in something, and especially people of our generation, because we grew up where he was already kind of a... Not a joke, but you know what I mean. The jokes were already there about him being this fat nutcase.
The 90s were very big on fat Brando jokes, which I think is just a bit churlish, really. I mean, gives a shit.
I mean, to be fair, in the 90s, he did make The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Well, I mean, he's got a lot of sins. Well, Abby, what's the film he's basically a religious scattercushion in?
Isn't that... Columbus, The Journey.
I like she's, she was like, no, just, yep, that is the film. I'm just telling you.
Most of the, like, a lot of 90s pop culture was full of jokes, either about The Godfather or about Kurtz from Apocalypse Now, so... Yeah. It's either usually that stuff or early Brando where he was really good in stuff like Streetcar Named Desire, and that's about all I've ever really known.
And like classic characters he's played.
Whenever I saw this, or when I watched this, I had no point of reference for this kind of Marlon Brando.
There's a lot of generic Brando as well. There's lots of films like he turns up, but he just does an okay job and stuff, like unremarkable characters. And you know, the guy had a career. He didn't just do good stuff. I guess.
Yeah, what was that? Free Money was that one where he was just like, oh, hello, Brando. Oh, goodbye.
Okay. He's just a De Niro in something like, and anyway,
the score.
Well,
yeah, I think
he's such a mythical kind of presence because of where his career went that it's almost kind of weird seeing him play a normal person a lot of the time.
Well,
yeah.
Well, for me, or, it's a bit like this is where Brando gets a bit more like Nicolas Cage. When Nicolas Cage does a weird film, it's like, fuck it, I'm going to just baffle you with this. I felt like that's what he was doing, is he was just dicking around for his own amusement some of the time, anyway.
Yeah, this is Brando in full, like, Nicolas Cage, Vampire's Kiss, or what's that other one where he's got a moustache? And it's Michael Biehn and him, and he's only in it a bit.
Deadfall.
Deadfall, that's it. And he's only in it for, like, a few minutes, but he's full on in it. And
that's
like,
great in Deadfall. Hi, fucking, yeah! Best line.
That's kind of what Brando is doing in this. He's just kind of sort of doing his own thing. According to a lot of the trivia and the background on the film, no one really knew why he was doing the stuff he was doing, and no one was expecting it. So in the end, it was just sort of, all right, fuck it. Well, we'll let him do his thing, and we'll just film his scenes around whatever the fuck he's doing. Mm. And I think Nicholson was fine because they were neighbours and they already knew each other before this.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Can you imagine that? Just a conversation over the fence like Tim Allen and Wilson in Home Improvement, but it's Jack Nicholson and Marlon Brando. 70s Jack Nicholson and Marlon Brando. So they were okay working together, I think, just because Jack Nicholson was probably his, like, apologist on set. I would imagine, and had to, you know, keep everybody calm while he did his thing. But I think one of the downsides of Marlon Brando being so fantastically bizarre in this film is you kind of forget that there's other actors in it giving pretty good performances too. Because Jack Nicholson does give a decent performance, and he's another actor who's got he brings certain expectations with him because of a lot of other roles, especially now. You know, I would say sort of post-Joker Jack Nicholson is when he became almost a parody of himself. Not because of him, but because, like, people just started associating him with a certain type of performance.
Yeah, the kind of quirky Daffy Duck character.
Yeah, and when you go back and watch, like, stuff like this, like his roles, especially in the 70s, because, like I said, this was post One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you realise that, like, he's really talented and he gives a very particular type of performance, but he is able to say a lot with just facial expressions and the way he carries himself.
Yeah.
He's one of those actors who, because he's such a larger-than-life personality, you forget that how much subtlety he puts into a lot of his best performances.
He's a very believable horse thief because he comes across as a bit dumb, like, but, you know, the smartest one, the leader of a gang of people who have to resort to nicking horses for a living. They want the easy life, but they're, you know, they're not career criminals.
But he's really good, and he's good because I could see where this easily could have been coming on the back of Cuckoo's Nest. He could have just played it as McMurphy again, a kind of like, you know, wild card, like rebellious rogue. And instead he just plays it as he's just some guy who is sort of, he's self-assured enough, but he's also a little bit out of his depth. And the idea that he takes to keeping this little farm is nice, is really nicely done. And I really liked his relationship with Braxton is the character's name, but I don't remember the Kathleen Lloyd, Jane Braxton, and their odd sort of romance that's awkward and
What I liked about it, right, is Jack Nicholson is basically this hairy, sweaty rancher, often in mud. Just he's kind of posing as a rancher, you know, and stuff. But he's not like damn sexy, you know. Like, and this woman is just like, I am going to fuck this guy.
And then a total non Jack Nicholson character trait. She comes, she's too eager, and he's like, no. Like, he plays hard to get.
Yeah.
That was a weird scene. Like, I don't think they quite primed it properly.
Yeah.
For that, well. But I do like that was the sort of tone they were going for.
Yeah. Well, that says more about that new, like, the new Hollywood thing in the 70s, where people were starting to put in more realistic or more grounded interactions between characters like that. Like, there was a push towards that sort of naturalism, even in a genre film like this, which is where you get interactions like that from. Because that felt, not perfectly, but it felt like fairly real, or at least I could understand what they were going for with that scene. And I liked that it was in there, that there was that attempt. I also liked Kathleen Lloyd in this. I really liked her just very natural kind of performance as Jane Braxton.
Yeah, I really liked her as well. There was an awkwardness to her.
Yeah, she seemed like a real person.
That's unusual. Yeah.
Yeah, especially for a woman in a, I mean, this isn't really a Western. It's more of a sort of period drama.
Wait, what?
Well,
it's a period drama set in the West, though.
Yeah, but a Western has its own connotation. Exaggerated, you know, dramatic, over the top. This is a Western in a very, very technical sense.
Cowboy
like,
hats,
it's much... Horses. Yeah, I mean, setting. It's much more about... Like, it's a much, much more of a character piece than a typical Western. Okay, I guess it's not a typical Western. Like, it doesn't necessarily feel like a Western in the way a lot of them do.
Yeah, I understand what you mean, yeah.
Also, before I forget as well about performances, fucking Harry Dean Stanton. I love Harry Dean Stanton.
And that fucking moustache and haircut. Oh, he looked like he was straight out of Peaky Blinders.
He did.
Great hair.
But, I didn't realise how, when he's introduced in the film, I didn't realise how good his character was going to become.
He's got such a hangdog face, isn't he?
Yeah.
Like, droopy, like, from, like, the dog droopy. He's just, like, depressed, yeah.
But he's so, like, with it. He's so stoic in this film. I always kind of... And again, he's another actor who, most of the time, you see him in a particular role. So I always expect him to be a little bit of a sort of, I guess, underdog sort of character. Someone who's been a bit sidelined.
Bit thrown on by life.
Yeah, whereas in this, he's more commanding than I normally see him in stuff.
He's interesting. He's like Jack Nicholson's... he's the second kind of... He's Jack Nicholson's second in the gang. He's smart and he knows what he's doing. He's inexperienced. And he's a nice, different character to Nicholson. But, you know, they're on an even pegging for, you know, being the serious ones in the gang.
Yeah, there isn't... There's an interesting dynamic because they're not necessarily rivals. They're not doing the whole, you know, vying for control thing.
Yeah.
But they could potentially both be the leader of the gang, but in very different ways.
They have their I guess they have their roles within the gang, isn't it?
Yeah.
And his is, like you say, stoic, but there's also this sense, like, they do a little bit of character development, which I think is quite good, and they set him up, he's less of a ladies' man, and he seems to have this chip on his shoulder. He has this story about his uncle, or his, the guy who raised him.
Yeah, his uncle and the dog.
Yeah, and basically the dog ate some butter, and then the guy was like, we're going to kill that dog, because,
yeah.
Abby, how did you feel about a dog being killed in a story in a film?
Well, it got vengeance.
Got vengeance? Oh, I see.
Harry Dean Stanton did. Yeah, he avenged the dog.
He did. So you're all right.
So I think that in filmic terms, that's a clean slate.
Good. It would be odd for you to put forward a film where dogs die, because you're so against
it. It doesn't die on screen.
It's there. It's a talking point. But this dog in the past ate some butter, got killed for it, and he went, like, fuck you, Uncle Douchebag. I'm burning your house down, nicking all your shit, and I'm being a career horse rustler.
He also killed his stud bull.
Prick. That's fair enough. But that puts him in this weird thing where he's always, like, you got a sense that there's just towards the end, you get a feeling, like, oh man, your whole... Like, he basically says he's never really been interested in much outside of horse wrestling since that dog incident. He's never had much affection for women because he hasn't had happiness since childhood or something. So he's got this dark side and this... Like, the only time he perks up and is happy is when they're robbing some Mounties of their horses. He's like, right, this is my time to shine. We're going to nick these horses. Yeah. Shut up, idiots in the gang. I'm fucking in charge. Let's nick those idiots in red coats horses.
I really enjoyed hearing those Mounties sing while they stole horses.
Oh, my God.
That was great.
They're such, like, Boy Scouts, aren't they, Mounties? Portrayed in this film, they're just... fair enough, but...
Shoot that one guy's finger off.
Yeah, but, you know. Abby, you're part Canadian. Mounties,
I am.
How did you feel they portrayed Mounties?
What?
Abby's parents... Abby's dad is from Canada.
Since fucking when?
This has come up before, although maybe not in the shows you were actually in, which shows that listen to the shows that you're not in.
Of course I don't.
In fact, Abby's dad has lived in Britain for a long time. But he is Canadian.
My granddad was the legit Canadian.
Wow.
Wait, no, this came up in Strange Brew.
Did it?
Yes. I was the only one who didn't do the Canadian accent because I was actually
offended. Canadian.
It was very passing. We didn't, go into a whole, Abby's family history or anything. There's not much to the story. It's, just on a technicality, Abby is part Canadian because of her dad.
My granddad was legit Canadian. My dad is also legit Canadian, but he left so young. It's not really. And I have technical Canadian citizenship.
But
and my
no Mounties in the family.
Went back to live there fairly recently.
So, how did you feel that Mounties, as a Canadian, do you feel the Mounties were portrayed as complete douchebags or heroes to be admired? How did you feel about it as a Canadian, just as Jamie's an American now?
Well, the guys robbed them on a Sunday while they were in church. Then, in a fairly organised fashion, the Mounties got themselves together, tracked them down, shot them up a bit and got their horses back. I think that's fairly efficient.
We may be noobs who like singing really raucously in a church, but God damn it if we don't do our job.
I did like the when the Mounties jump the gang as they're making off with the horses and then basically take the horses back. Like it's a great sort of yeah, we did it, and then the Mounties just jump in and go, hang on a minute.
And they're all kind of butthurt because they're like, but they came into America and robbed us. That's against the law. It's like,
yeah, when he said that's not even legal, I was like, yeah.
Just like Oxford. Yeah,
that was good. That was I liked that. There's a lot of nice little touches in that. Also, we were talking about idiots in the gang. Randy Quaid's character,
yes,
Todd.
Yeah, young Randy Quaid looked about as much like a hobo as current Randy Quaid.
The best bit is he's the one where his hat brim broke, isn't it?
Yeah.
When he's like, he's escaping from, I think, the Mounties when they get the... basically, the gang consists of Jack Nicholson and... what are the character names? We should talk about them as characters. Jack Nicholson is called...
Oh, 1 moment, please.
Ah, but yes, give us the character names. Because it's basically two serious guys and a bunch of retards. Like, just
completely... Okay, of the gang...
Yes.
Jack Nicholson is Tom Logan. Randy Quaid is Little Todd. Harry Dean Stanton is Calvin.
You don't really give a shit about the other ones.
Dopey. Dumb and
Dumber. The two guys who kind of look the same.
Yeah, they do a bit. And when Jack Nicholson saw him, like, he was in a coffin at one point after he'd been killed. And Jack Nicholson's like, ah! And you go, wait. That guy was in your... Because he's had some... The Undertaker's done some makeup to make this corpse look okay. And he just... is he in your gang? Jack, you...
Just kind of looks like Tom Hardy.
You've reminded me of fantastic moments that must not go without comment.
Yeah.
And that's when Lee Clayton first shows up and it's that guy's funeral.
Oh, and he picks him up out of the coffin.
Yes!
Brando just fucking...
And cost this man's life!
Such an insensitive prick.
And the tooth. What was the tooth thing about? You'll have to excuse me. I'm under attack from a tooth. Oh, and then it just doesn't come up again. I thought that was going to be a thing, but I guess it was just something he decided to do while they were filming that scene.
This is a film made up of really great moments, actually. I mean, we get a good bog kill. Like the second best bog kill after, Jurassic
you mean
Park.
Bog as in... Yeah, toilets. As in toilet, not
shot,
as in...
Shot in the dunny.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's just a... Sorry, go on.
You got this, Jurassic Park, and Pulp Fiction.
I think Pulp Fiction may be second. Then this. Now that I think of other...
Yeah,
ones,
this doesn't top the lawyer on the toilet.
Like, it's a crack shot. Like, it's basically Brando... he gets shot in the outhouse and comes flying out and falls down bleeding and freaks a kid out and stuff. And, like, because basically, this is the story of Brando finding all the gang, just, you know, killing them one by one and finding out who's going to be left.
Though, that doesn't happen until, the last 20 minutes. And that's where I want to, bring up my major criticism of this film is it's fucking slow.
But it's full of moments, Jamie, like the whole tooth thing, the coffin.
Anything
with Brando, he does something weird. The bath scene where Jack Nicholson confronts him and he's very flippant.
And,
yeah, he's like, I need to go and have my food. And Jack Nicholson's like, fuck you, mate. You killed my best friends and I am here to kill you in the bath. I don't care. You know, and
then he just
feels weird.
Makes the bath leak.
You shoot the hole in the bath and, he says not to kill him, yeah.
I mean, yeah, but I think when I say it's boring or it's dull, it's not what's happening in from scene to scene, because taken by themselves, most of the scenes in the film individually are pretty well done, but sometimes it feels like they're not in the right order, and there are moments of the film still, even looking back at it now, where I was confused and didn't really understand what was going on, and also who was talking, because this film does have that thing going on that, again, was a 70s and maybe late 60s thing that a lot of filmmakers did, and I think it was that move towards being more sort of natural. Spielberg did it, Robert Altman did it a lot, Francis Ford Coppola does it quite a bit as well, where you have a lot of characters talking over each other at the same time.
You can blame Robert Altman for that, because he did that in MASH. That was the first time, I think, that it possibly been done.
Huh. And I mean, for a certain type of film, that works. Or if it's done in the right way, or for a particular reason to create a certain feeling, it works. But I didn't feel like it worked in this film, and there were a lot of moments where I was just confused as shit and didn't know who was saying what. And part of it was there were some odd moments of poorly done ADR in this film where someone looked badly dubbed. Voice levels were strange, so it didn't feel like the dialogue was coming from the film.
I can't say I had any problems of this kind. Abby, did you, Jamie's sort of been talking about the pacing a little bit as well. Did you, Abby, feel the pacing was good in this? Did it keep you engaged, or were there slow moments for you?
I thought it was all right. Like, I've seen worse. So, yeah, I've got some criticisms, but it would be unfair to criticise this one, like, more than I would criticise others, or less than I would criticise others.
So what do you think the selling point for this is, then? Because you haven't quite said what you champion about it, other than we've talked about Brando and
it's clearly Marlon Brando, isn't it?
But is there other elements to this you like? Because it can't stand alone on him, because he's not the whole film. Is there something else about this you like, you know?
Well, there were certain... like you say, it's about the touches rather than the thing of its own. Like, I really liked some of the ways that they did things that were less common at the time, but are more common now. Like, when he found... Let me just check that guy's name again. When he found Calvin, they had a wide shot where Tom Logan was walking in with his horse, and he was looking around, and he sees Calvin at a distance. And then when he gets over closer to him, just the way that he's very still, he's slumped, and he's got that blood coming out of his eye. Mm. And it's little things like that where then it wasn't that common to just see someone like that. It wasn't theatrical, it wasn't staged. He was just there, and he was dead.
That scene, and I really liked the scene where Calvin, Harry Dean Stanton's character, is caught by Brando, not just because Marlon Brando's dressed up as an old lady.
Which is amazing. He looks like Mr. Toad when he's trying to break out of prison.
Yeah, and the fact that he calls himself Granny is also fantastic.
That's the thing, is Brando is entertaining himself on his own a lot. Like, his character, even, is meant to be just amusing himself, keeping himself amused. Go on.
But initially it's funny when he first emerges dressed like that. Yeah. But after a while, when, like, he sets fire to the cabin Stanton's in, and then Calvin runs out, jumps in the river because he's on fire, and then for a minute I thought they were just going to play it for comedy, but then he comes out and he's burnt.
Yeah.
And clearly in pain. And then there's Brando standing against the shot of the little wood cabin burning.
In a dress.
And Marlon Brando, he's big.
And his body has gone awry.
Yeah, and it actually becomes really eerie and kind of cool, which I was sort of sitting there going, I don't know why, but there's something really, really cool about this image, and it's Marlon Brando in drag against a burning house in the dark.
Yeah, and Stanton's there just sort of feeling a bit sorry for himself because he's burnt. And he's just sitting there, like, I can't get away. And then there's this fucking... Like, he doesn't even care that there's a mad, eccentric Irishman in a dress, like, jabbering away. He's just sitting there, like, accepting things.
He's heard of him before. He was one of the... When shit started to go sideways, he was like, yeah, that guy, didn't he?
Yeah, he knows who he is.
Thanks for that. So but, he knows all about Lee Clayton and his mad hattery.
And it's a good choice to have him... Because he's not eccentric in any way, he's just a ranch, like a horse rustler. It's the perfect victim for Brando, because you properly feel sympathy, especially when he throws that stupid pointy thing in his face and kills him. It's just so brutal.
The Kroll Star.
The Kroll Star, right, yeah.
But it's almost like the Joker successfully killing Batman.
I guess so.
Because Stanton is very stoic, but obviously has a past that has damaged him, and that's made him... And then you've got the chaotic Brando character.
We don't know why Brando does what he does as well. There's a point where he's like, I don't give a shit about being paid. Once the job starts, I see it through. And it's like, but where's the living in this? You can't travel around like just killing people that you've been hired to, even if you don't get paid. Like, he does his job to the point where he fucks up the guy he's hired by his life by... Like, he lets the horses get nicked. Yeah. He does nothing to stop the crimes. He just wants to kill the criminals.
I think that's the implication, is that he's basically a bloodthirsty maniac that uses being a regulator as an excuse to fuck with people and then kill them.
Yeah, and it does. You don't know that until very late. It's all the way through he's eccentric, and it's only by the time by the time the film concludes, you're like, that guy was just sick. Like,
It says something for the sort of ingenuity of the director and maybe the editing team as well to take the messy nature of Brando's sort
what
of ad-libbing
as a performance.
Yeah, yeah, and to turn it into this sort of arc where initially he's very silly and
he does just become sinister in the end. Yeah,
yeah. After you get used to how silly he is, you start to realize that there is a method behind it, and you start to understand what he's moving towards. And then you get to that point where he is dressed up as Granny. But it's kind of not funny anymore. It actually is a bit intimidating and weird. Like,
from a character perspective, I think the idea is this guy is a professional killer and he likes doing that, but the way he makes everyone feel at ease and not afraid of him because he's so weird, people take him for granted. And like, because at times he's trying to, like, he talks to some of the dumber crew. He has that one scene actually with it's Quaid, isn't it?
And yeah.
He finds Quaid running away from the Mounties, and we're going to talk about it. The brim of his hat is broke, so it falls down over his face. He's just in this window of the brim of his hat, and he spends a while being flummoxed and talking, with just his face peeping through his brim. And anyway, he has like he's accosted by Brando, and Brando's dressed as a priest this time, and he's like, "Come and share me, rabbit." And they have a campfire.
No, he doesn't. He's not Irish at that point.
He's a priest though, so I assumed he was Irish.
No, he drops the Irish accent.
But he, as I say, he's playing, like, so the bounty hunter is playing innocent priest, you know, and trying very obviously to find out about what the guy is. He's trying to investigate, find proof that he is a horse rustler, and Brando says he's a horse rustler to kind of get him on side. And for the first time ever, the dumb guy's like, shut up, I ain't telling you what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But I liked the scene because it showed that he's not, you know, totally unguessable. You can tell when he's, like, manipulating
people. He's not
people.
Insane. Like, he's more, like, of a sociopath. Like, he's messing with people.
And this is his method. And it's not foolproof. But he because he's so odd, it gets the other characters' guards down, including the people who hire him, and have laughed at him and thinks he's odd. But really, he's this calculated, like, tracker of people. It's an interesting duality of this innocent-looking weirdo and then the killer that he is, really.
Yeah. I also like the way that he just fucking drowned Randy Quaid.
Fucking hell, yeah.
That was...
He just tricked him into drowning himself because he couldn't swim. It was brutal. I mean, what do you think? Did you enjoy the brutal murders, or did it, you know, put you on edge?
It was so cold. Yeah. Oh, just chilling.
that's another thing that this, I think, is a strength of this film, is it isn't very violent, but when it is, it's really kind of graphic with it. Like Harry Dean Stanton's death and then the discovery later on when Logan finds him sitting against the tree. Mm. But there's also that... the actual scene where he's killed is fantastic. Like that sudden throw of the... whatever the freaking weapon is, and then it impales itself in Harry Dean Stanton's eye. Yeah. And it was really, it's a really sudden and moment of violence that's kind of shocking because there's so little of it in the rest of the film.
Hmm. And they're pseudo-comical as well. Like, most of the kills are kind of... I mean, apart from the one, the drowning, where he just tricks him into crossing the Missouri River, huh? Finally, we get a reason for the film. There's a river in it they have to cross a couple of times. Who gives a shit? One guy gets drowned in it. But he tricks the guy into thinking he's coming across the river with him and then lets him go. But that's a bit brutal. But the other comedy one is some guy is at he's selling his horses they've nicked at the end of the film. And he's just basically banging the guy's wife up against the outhouse or something again. And Brando just shoots him from off camera and the woman's like, "Ah, I've had a man killed while another... he's in me. Like...
That was another little moment of realism that I liked, was that kind of weird, awkward, dry sex scene. Yeah, yeah. We were just kind of fumbling about, like, you've got 5 minutes. Like, it was so...
going, like, dry.
Yeah, chafing.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
But, it's... Yeah, and I mean... Brando's character actually reminds me of... something that... This film feels like it could have been... Or it could be a Coen Brothers film.
Yeah, it is a bit, isn't it?
If it had, like, if you tightened it up a little bit.
A little quirkier and a little more intricate. Yeah.
But it's got that sort of feel to it. And then that also reminds me of a similar link in that, because the Coen brothers did the adaptation of Cormac McCarthy's No Country for Old Men. And in the 80s, Cormac McCarthy wrote a book which is probably his most well known outside of No Country and The Road. It was a book called Blood Meridian. And it's one of my favorite books, and it's kind of a really surreal and dark, almost biblical kind of take on the Western. And it follows a group of men who are scalp hunters. Like they go around just killing and scalping Native Americans and then selling the scalps. Anyway, it's based, like, it's somewhat based on historical events that McCarthy takes and turns into sort of myths. And one of the characters in it, and probably the most famous character in it, is the judge.
Right.
And I think it's Judge Holden, who, again, I think is loosely based on a historical figure. But in the book, he's almost a supernatural kind of figure. And he's this giant man who he's got alopecia or something. He's completely hairless and he's giant,
right,
fat, bald.
Bringing it round to Missouri Breaks, Jimmy.
I'm failing
to see the link.
No, wait, but the judge is almost the embodiment of people's brutality and the brutality of the West at that time,
right?
And there's almost the idea that he's sort of feeding it into the violence of this group and what they're doing and where they are, and feeding off it at the same time. But the way he acts, he's very kind of like mischievous and impish, and he likes to fuck with people. He gets some people killed on purpose. There's actually a lot of similarities between that character, at least how I imagined him when I read that book, and Marlon Brando's character in this, because they're almost... it's almost like, coming back to the Joker, it's like Heath Ledger's version of the Joker. There's almost like an elemental idea to the character. Like,
well, it's interesting what you said about the judge, because the judge you're talking about, you know, this film opens with like a kangaroo court that decides to hang a guy, and that's one of Jack Nicholson's gang members, and they're all a bit bummed about it. And when they hire Brando, he is almost feeding off of their... Well, they wanted someone to hunt down these people and kill them, even though they should just be arrested, probably. And so they get more than what they bargained for, and they don't, you know... It is... I can see what you're saying about this... this thing, it does sound
It's that whole idea of an agent of chaos. Like, they bring Brando in to sort this all out, and he just makes it worse on purpose, because he likes messing with it, and he likes the excitement and the violence of it.
Yeah.
It is
like that. It's only upon reflection, actually, because most of the time, you're kind of... Like, the thing I think that stops it being about this interesting character piece of the agent of chaos is we have this kind of other story going on. There's Jack Nicholson knocking around, killing some time while the rest of his gang are going to he has to hold the ranch that they've bought. And so he's growing cabbages, making cool irrigation thingies, and basically banging a fairly up for it lady who lives locally, who is the daughter of the man who hired Brando to hunt down the horse thieves.
Braxton.
Abby, Abby, did you enjoy the semi-romantic comedy we had from these two characters? Did you think it was a worthy story?
Sort of, yes and no.
Because
on the one hand, it doesn't go anywhere, but it's sort of nice at the same time.
It ends, isn't it?
Their relationship, like in terms of the film, it ends with them possibly meeting up again later, but it is not guaranteed.
It's a very reasonable. They're a very progressive couple in a sense, because I mean, she's obviously the naive, I've lived out in the boonies for ages. Like, she's country-born lady, and she hates it, though. Yeah, and she wants to live in the city, and this bandit comes, and he's a bit of rough that she fancies. And she's very forward, and she said she's not reserved at all. She's, you know, giving him reverse cowgirls, literally, on his horse. And she basically hooks up with him. And there's an interesting dynamic with Jack Nicholson, the way he plays off against her and stuff. But I thought it was interesting that she was fairly blasé about the murder of her father. And there is this sense of, well, I can look after myself. I'm going to sort out my life and we'll meet up later. And like she was having a very modern relationship with Jack Nicholson at a time when that kind of thing probably wouldn't happen.
I think it comes back to that more realistic portrayal of people's relationships. The way there is, I guess, because of the whole situation with her father and how that plays out. But there's no drama in their sort of love story element of it. Like, the drama doesn't come from that. And they essentially break up, but in a very... in the way that some people do just in real life sometimes, where it just kind of falls flat and they go, all right, well, and they just wave at each other. Like, it's not played for drama. It's just part of what happens to them.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things about this film that, depending on what you like in films, could be a strength or a weakness, is it doesn't quite feel like it has that flow of beginning, middle, and end.
No.
And it's sort of got a patchy sort of pacing to it, which usually comes from, and this is, I was surprised when I found out it wasn't based on a book, because that kind of pacing happens when you get a film that tries really hard to stick to material that was originally written. As like a book or...
not a script, anyway.
Not a screenplay that was specifically written to be paced like a film.
But in this case, that's what
Yeah, which is weird, because it feels like it was based on a book, partly because of the subject matter, because typically things like this usually are, but also the way it's structured and the way it doesn't have that momentum.
I agree. It's the sort of thing that you can imagine being indulged upon in a novel, but it does seem odd. It does feel like one, I agree. You agree as well, Abby, do you?
Yeah, I was surprised it wasn't one either. Mm. Especially with that sort of title as well. I feel it has a very bookish title.
Yeah. What I thought was interesting, from a narrative perspective, was Jack Nicholson starts off as this let's rob a bank. There's quite a funny, like, they rob a train at one point and it goes badly. They kind of fall off a bridge, and like there's a lot of like comedy of errors there, and they're basically a shit gang, like, and that's too much for them. They should stick to horse stealing. But it sets him up as like, well, they're, you know, live by the seat of their pants bandits who, you know, spend their money on whores and they don't settle down. And for the first time in his life, seemingly, Jack Nicholson's character is sat there with nothing to do but look after a ranch. So he ends up kind of just tending to it and
enjoying
it. And quite liking settling down. And I feel like that gets disturbed by Brando sticking his oar in and being this investigative asshole with funny suits on. And it's like, you're spoiling. Jack Nicholson's going to turn a corner and become a half-decent anti-hero father something.
That's a fairly common theme in fiction that focuses on, like, an anti-hero, is that you get someone who's done something bad or a lot of bad stuff and is just about starting to turn a corner and learn something or become a better person, and then something comes in and just ruins it. Like, that's a fairly sort of common trope of anti-hero kind of genre, but you know what I mean? Like, the idea of an anti-hero is that they almost get better and then something comes along and just throws them back into it again.
Yeah, but like you say about the odd structure, it, you didn't know it was building to that. You weren't sure. You thought maybe there'd be tension between the lady's father and the fact that he's after the, like, it's, you know, it's an interesting, the fact that Jack Nicholson is very friendly with them and buys the ranch, and he's kind of, you know, getting in with the locals a bit so that he can better rob them, I suppose, or be trusted in the community so that he's not suspected. And then Brando's like, fuck that, I know. I'm going to piss you off and kill you and your friends.
Yeah,
so
it, like, does a lot.
It avoids the obvious tension and then becomes about something else. And I guess because you can't guess where it's going, it has that odd feel where you didn't know. There's not the formula that you're expecting, so it kind of fucks with you. But that's, I think, like you said, Jamie, it could be good or bad. And for me, that's a really strong point, is it? It kept me guessing, I didn't know where it was going, and that makes me interested rather than confused.
It does a good job of taking you by surprise a few times. Like, it subverts certain expectations. I thought there was going to be a showdown at some point between Brando and Nicholson, but instead he just slits his throat while he's asleep, completely by surprise.
And then all of a sudden, after the best scene Brando has, where he chats up his horse, he sings to it.
He pisses.
And the best bit, my favourite bit, is Brando has a donkey and a horse, and he loves the horse and is nice to it, and he's a prick to the donkey. he teases it with a carrot and then hits it on the nose and gives the carrot to the horse. And he wants a kiss off the horse, and he's holding the horse's face and kisses
it. Lady and the Tramp him. Yeah.
And then he like puts the carrot in his mouth so that the horse eats the carrot and he kisses the horse. And it's like,
do you think,
what is this? Is this a bestiality thing or like a bestiality? Like,
is he gonna fuck the horse? Is this gonna be like a Marlon Brando Mr. Hands kind of situation?
Oh my god, Abby, do you think? Brando was genuinely in love with the horse or just doing it for his own amusement?
I think he spent a sufficient amount of time on his own to be confused in most aspects of his life.
Is this the actor Brando or the character we're talking about?
Yeah, I can't tell which one you mean.
Both. Let's say both.
Can you imagine being on the crew while they were filming that? And everyone's just kind of sitting behind the cameras, just being like...
There's a guy looking at the script going, this isn't in the script, guys. We didn't write anything about him singing to the horse. And then he puts his feet up and he starts playing the harmonica and singing a love song to the horse. And the horse pisses and he stops playing. And he looks at the horse all affronted like, you're pissed during my love song. Well,
pissed on my song.
Yeah, it's just like, it's the weirdest bit of oddball comedy. Yeah, I loved it. And then he gets his throat slit after that by Jack Nicholson, who's been very cautious and frightened because all his friends keep dying. So he's on edge, and then he just gets one up on him, and it's like, fuck.
I just imagined, like, that bit where he puts the carrot in his mouth, and they're approaching the kiss. Someone sitting next to, like, Arthur Penn while he's, like, directing, being like, do you want to call cut? Because I'm a bit worried he's going to, like, fuck it.
No, I think the opposite, see. I think everyone's behind the camera, gripping onto each other's hands and arms, just not wanting to breathe or speak. Because half of them are going to laugh, the other half don't know what the fuck's going on.
I also like the idea that Brando was just, when they weren't shooting, he was just being nice to the horses. And he started talking to them weird. And he started, like, he's like, oh, kiss first before the carrot. And
I like, wonder if they
that's
just...
That's amazing, you've got to do that in this film.
I'm actually starting to wonder now whether he didn't even know the cameras were rolling at that point.
I think he might have made a porn with a horse after this shit. It's really weird. And a Millicent Boone romance as well. Like, not just a filthy, you know, horrible thing. A loving, tender romance about a man and a horse who love each other but are different species.
Well, they knew when to call cut when he was being friendly to the horse and then he asked someone to get him some butter.
It was awkward when they mentioned butter in a different thing. I was like, oh, don't mention butter around.
Not with them.
I don't want to make you think of Tango in Paris and the realities of that.
But that's what I mean. It's such a weird scene with Clayton by himself. And then, yeah, he's woken up by having his throat cut by Jack Nicholson. And that's it. Yeah. Like, there's
he's such an extreme close-up as well.
Yeah, it's really uncomfortable. And it feels really visceral. And he has that, like, bright red 70s blood paint coming out of his mouth. But, like, it's just, it's the closeness of his face and the noises he's making. It's like, oh, this, well, okay.
I guess because they had their confrontation earlier. Like, when Jack Nicholson confronts him while he's having a bubble bath, it's a good back and forth. There's use of the bubbles, like Brando's being all affronted and coy and trying to, I don't know, he's almost trying to talk his way out of it by being eccentric, and he's trying to play down the severity of the shit he's in. And essentially, you know, the only ace up his sleeve Brando has is, like, the guy will obviously, if he can't just murder him in someone's house, he'll get, like, arrested and hung. So he's, you know, it'll be obvious who killed Brando, but Brando doesn't want to die. So,
there's also, it's a nice touch for Logan as well. Jack Nicholson is an outlaw. You know, he's a horse wrestler and he's robbed a train and stuff, but he's not necessarily a murderer. Like, he's not a killer. He hesitates at that point, even with how angry he is. He doesn't kill him. He ends up slitting his throat at the end just because he's been pushed to that point. Yeah. But then following that, he almost kills Jane Braxton's father, and then doesn't, mainly because of Vern, the old servant. He can't put away that feeling of, like, pity.
Yeah, it's an interesting servant as well, because he's like, it's that Old West thing of, like, the servants who live for their master and have this loyalty beyond any understandable amount. But it kind of works. There is a sense, like, I don't know, I felt like, you know, the character doesn't want to kill anyone.
Yeah.
But he's so pissed off and sad with all of his, like, friends dead that he's been pushed to this limit where he's like, well, I'm a career criminal, but I'm not a murderer, but I really fucking, you're yanking my fucking pubes over this, guys. I'm really getting pissed off and I'm going to do some killing. And, I like that he threw the kind of ornamental gun out the window, and then it ends in, like, a shootout between the, like, him, he's kind of, you know, shot himself, and then he has to defend himself and murder the guy.
Yeah.
And so, it was a good end to that, and it was dramatic.
It was a nice sort of sudden, kind of difficult shootout, rather than a typical, rather than a typical Pistols at Dawn kind of thing. It was like, suddenly Braxton shoots him, hits him, but doesn't kill him, just hurts him, and he has to sort of, he falls over and then shoots Braxton, and then Vern goes,
But also, because we'd had the previous tension in the bath scene earlier with Brando, I felt like, I don't know about you guys, but from watching, like, Eli Walsh in films, like, there's a scene where he's having a bath. I think it might be Good, the Bad, and Ugly. And he's having a bath, and he like, has a gun in the bath with him, and that's how he gets the one-up on whoever's after him. And he's like, if you've got to shoot, don't talk. And it's like, the guy baths with a gun, that's how fucking malicious he is. And I was kind of thinking, well, Brando, he's this tricky killer, is he gonna have, like, a gun hidden in the bath with him, and this is how he's, I thought we might have had a shootout then and there, and the situation's diffused, and then we have that later on, then we have a proper shootout to kind of let the violence happen when,
because it turns out Brando's just rolling around in the bubble bath like a seal.
It is, I mean,
big meaty man. That's what he was at this point. I like the fact that Jack Nicholson calls him fat as well.
Also, I like, because they have the leak from the bath, I like that later on in one of the scenes, they have the chandelier down because, you know, electrical shit.
Yeah, and he hits his head on it.
And he bashes, and it's like a nice little, you would be annoyed. Like, the chandelier would be down, and that would happen if that had occurred.
And it's, his reaction is great, because he just does it, and then doesn't draw attention to it. It's just kind of, fuck's sake.
There's a lot, The real strong point is these little moments all the way through. It kept me interested. I didn't feel lulls, like you mentioned. So for me, that's what I like about it, is lots of interactions between different characters, lots of more compelling characters, not the usual run-of-the-mill lot. I mean, some of the gang are a bit stupid, but in a lovable dope kind of way.
I wanted to mention something about the gang, actually.
Yes, dear.
I liked the way that there were little segues to them just titting about.
Yeah.
They were doing stuff. I really liked that. And how they're not just this bloodthirsty gang. They are just boys.
They're all a bit immature. There's Logan and there's Calvin even has that kind of boyishness. He's never, since he left his childhood home, he hasn't had a normal life, so he's still a bit like a naive young boy, even though he's much older and maturer than everyone.
Yeah.
They're just a bunch of ragtag, you know, guys trying to have an easier life of it, really, isn't it?
And yeah.
It's sad when they get killed, and Brando's a dick, and he's a shade fruity. It's really interesting. I Abby, I'm really glad you brought it to the table, and do not think there's any major problems for me. It's not for everyone. There are slow moments, but it makes me chuckle consistently, and I think, having talked about it now, there's a depth to it that I perhaps didn't appreciate on just first glance.
There's definitely a lot going on, and it's more interesting than I think it got credit for at the time. At the same time, I can see why it didn't do well at the box office.
Mm.
Like, there definitely wasn't an audience for this. Like, there wasn't much of an audience for, you know, whatever you want to call it, Western period drama, whatever. That wasn't much of a thing in the mid-70s. And at the same time, it does different enough things with where it's set and what the typical associations would normally be that it would also potentially put off, you know, maybe an older audience that missed Westerns, you know, John Wayne Westerns or whatever, and then would, like, see this and think, well, this is just modern rubbish. Where are the shootouts? Where are the engines? Like, all that, you know.
Yeah,
like,
you're right.
Where's the racism? Like,
I think I see what you mean now about it being a period piece and not a Western. It's like, yeah, Western is cowboys and Indians and we good bad, I mean, good guys and outlaws. And this is a period drama about anti-heroes and the idea of justice and things.
Yeah. But, like, part of that is, that subversive nature of it, the music, which is by John Williams, which surprised me when I found it out, because it's the most non-John Williams sounding score I think he's ever done. But the mix of acoustic guitar and the harmonica, which are very typical of that setting, and then really funky 70s bass every now and again. And, like, little bits of synth dropped in. It doesn't quite... Actually, it kind of sums up the film. The score is that mix of classic Western ideas with a little bit of, at the time, a modern twist that doesn't quite go together, but I can appreciate what he was doing when he composed it.
Hmm. Yeah. Abby, do you have any final thoughts or summaries on it? And maybe edge towards a metaphor? Because I think we're at that stage. Okay, just thinking. That's good. That's what I thought you'd gone then. I was like, fuck, not again.
I thought you just got bored and got up and left.
No, I'm trying to think, because we've covered a lot of the things about how it's about the moments, not the piece.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I feel. Like, there's a lot of good stuff in it, but for me, it didn't quite come together like it could have. I feel like it has the potential to be better.
But if you recall all the bits, it's like, oh, the Mountie bit, oh, the bit where they cross the river, oh, the bit in the bubble bath. There's loads of bits.
It's worth watching. And I can see why I read on something when I was reading about it that, like, it's developed sort of more of a following now than it did at the time. And I can see why. It's much, I almost want to say it was ahead of its time, saying that it reminded me of a Coen Brothers film. Mm. And I think with some more, maybe more brutal editing, just to tighten it up, and a little bit less of the, you know, people talking over each other that bothered me.
Just whap the Coen Brothers name on it. Everyone would be tricked. Yeah, it's the biggest part of the canon.
I think it's almost a classic. Like, if it had been given a bit more of a polish, and come together a little bit better. The intention and the performances and the integrity is in it, that it could have been something fantastic.
But it falls short a bit.
Just a bit, and it's that's a shame, because there is definitely something cool going on.
Well, dem's the breaks.
Oh.
Have you had time to gather your thoughts? Do you agree with Jamie, or the more you want to say on the matter?
No, I think, he's basically covered it then. I think my metaphor is going to be a mosaic.
Yes.
Where, the thing about mosaic is there, unless you're very, very lucky, there are usually points where a piece is just a little bit too small for the space you had, really, or it's a little bit too big, but they've put it together as best they absolutely can, and it still looks really good, but there are just little points and bits that aren't quite right.
To me, that sounds more like crazy paving. Because a mosaic, all the pieces are unremarkable, but the after-all effect is quite good. Where, if anything, you mean like the inverse of a mosaic, where all the individual tiles are quite good, but the overall, when they come together, it's not all that splendid, but you can enjoy the tiles individually.
Okay, I change it. It is the 1970s colour palette in fashion and design, where the individual colours were absolutely fine, but they decided to put them next to each other in ways that were just heinous and wrong.
Ooh, orange, brown and cream. Yes, please. that makes sense. Definitely. Like, if you have just the tie, that's fine. Or just the flared trousers. Maybe not the flared trousers. But, I get what you're saying. It makes sense what you're saying. I think you've done all right to swerve me criticising your mosaic metaphor, and you've come up with a reasonable response. I don't know what it's. I'm trying to think how it can relate to that poor donkey who was snubbed by Brando. What did the donkey even do? We didn't see any scene where it bucked or anything.
I didn't like
the donkey as much as the horse.
That's why I think they were just filming him do stuff, because he hits the donkey in the face. There's no way that was... Well, actually, did people give a shit about animal welfare in the 70s? I'm not sure they did.
They did. It didn't hit it properly. It just gave it a little tap.
I also don't know if he actually killed that rabbit, because it looked like it.
Well, they probably have it. The
moment where he throws the thing at it...
I don't think he killed... I don't think that was a live shot. That would be insane. They couldn't do that.
Well, no, but... It almost looked like they just stabbed the rabbit and then filmed it as it was trying to, get away.
It was part... Oh, yeah.
Gruesome. See?
I don't think that's allowed.
Yeah, but this was 1976.
You'd have to find...
The Animal Act came in. God. When did the Animal Act come in?
And when did people pay attention to it, is the question.
Yeah, you can't just consider when it came in.
You'd have to find a rabbit that naturally died on a point and then put it in the film. Well, it was fine because they were already dying.
There are films after this where animals were clearly probably killed.
But rabbit death aside, I feel... It's an underappreciated donkey. That's how I feel. I feel like Brando loves the horse, and that's a classical Western. The thing that John Wayne rootin' tootin' cowboy shit. And then there's this donkey that's doing all the hard work. And it's just a hard-working, good donkey, and I prefer it to the boring clichés of the stallion. So, for me, the film is a bit of a donkey. It's underappreciated. Mm. But it's actually, it's a good part of the team. It's a good member of the Western family. So it's a badly treated donkey that deserves the carrot that people are so begrudging to give it. Does that make sense?
Sure.
I didn't want to just say something about many parts, because I think the listeners get, we thought it was many good parts, but didn't come together in the end, necessarily. But for me,
I'm going to stick to my... John Williams' score for the film actually summing up how I feel about it.
Yeah.
And that, it's cool, and I quite like what he's doing, but it isn't quite good enough. It's one of those. It's one of those CDs that you wouldn't play when anyone's around. You want to listen to it in front of anyone.
Yeah, and not in a, like, it's shameful, like ABBA or something.
No,
like,
it's just...
Well, I like it, but no one's going to be tolerating me playing this.
Yeah.
Like, that's the soundtrack to fucking Star Wars. I don't know, like, that's, I wouldn't listen to
that. Yeah, no,
but like, just when, a sort of soundtrack like when... was I was too indulgent, but I quite like it for when I'm just doing my own thing.
I don't know, like, listening to video game soundtracks.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of feel like listening to the theme from Metal Gear Solid, but I don't want anyone to know I'm listening to it.
You're not putting it on shuffle.
Private session on Spotify for that one.
Well, it's too late now. People know your dirty secret is out.
Solid music all the time.
The Misery Breaks. We chatted about it. And if you haven't seen it, go see it. And if you have seen it, agree with us. by looking us up on Twitter or Facebook or whatever.
I like that, you know, don't discuss it. Just like, if you have seen it, it's good, isn't it?
Send us a message on iTunes. We're on there. Spoiler-filled film in the search should find us. Spoiler-filled film conversation, hooray, if you want to make sure, you know, but check us out.
Tell us we're wrong, too. Tell us why it's shit.
I know, come on, race. Twitter troll. You're sitting there all day. I've seen you getting your YouTube comments on and going, oh, I'm going to tell these guys they're pricks even though I enjoyed it. So we're happy.
Wait, that's happy me.
Happy to hear you. I've so often I enjoy. There's lots of people on YouTube I enjoy, and all the comments I ever want to do are, oh, you shouldn't have said that one bit. That was shit. And it's like, I love your work. I don't tell them any of the praise, but I have to stop myself just criticizing the one thing I don't like. I remember that people have feelings. But anyway, we don't have feelings, do we, guys? Don't give a shit. Say what you want. Tell us we're shit, and we should cut the podcast down. Tell us anything you like, but just tell us something, yeah?
Well, that's desperation.
Well, if you got to the end of this, I mean, what the fuck? Like, if you didn't tune out after my niece introduced us, then, I don't know, like, well done for getting this far, and then still thinking, I'm not bloody commenting, you won't goad me into it. But yeah, you know, stay tuned for more film chat on other podcasts, right, guys?
Sure,
why not? Yeah!
More, but better. Join us next time, or check out our old shit. Love you. Bye. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Hold your horses. Pun slightly intended. It's me. I've just recorded this after the podcast because I realised we got through the whole bloody thing, all of Missouri Breaks. We even talked to Abby about her sort of Canadianness in relation to the film. And we completely missed the fact that Jamie, even though he's from Welshland, lives currently in Missouri. I mean, that is a glaring omission that we did not divulge more information. We could have asked him stuff about the Old West. It's obviously living there in the 2000s-ish, it is. You know, that directly relates to the cattle ranching film, and we could have found out all kinds of contemporary insight. Or I don't know. It seemed weird, though, that we didn't bring it up, so I thought I should add it on to the podcast. I mean, what the fuck? I mean, technically, the Missouri River doesn't just run through Missouri, which is where Jamie is currently living with his lovely family. Shout out. But, you know, it wasn't that relevant, I suppose. But still, we did a film called Missouri Breaks. If we did a fucking film called, like, Wales Breaks, that would probably be about some kind of economic crisis. I don't know. But the point is, fuck's sake. That's it. That's all I wanted to say. Fuck's sake. How did we not ask Jamie about Missouri when he fucking lives there? The cunt. Ah. Anyway. Goodbye again. Bye.